Hi, I'm Spencer.
And I'm Andrew, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today we'll be speaking with Scott Smith, founder and managing partner of the futures consultancy Changist. Based in The Hague in the Netherlands, Scott has consulted for organizations including UNICEF, the International Federation of Red Cross, and the Royal Society.
Scott is the author of the new book, How to Future, Leading and Sensemaking in an Age of Hyperchange. He has also contributed to publications including The Atlantic, Quartz, and Wired.
With more than 25 years' experience in forecasting, he has this unique ability to make sense of where we are and where we might be going, especially in regards to all the critical issues that we share. Can't think of a better moment to speak to Scott. Let's get him on the line. Hi, Scott. Welcome to At a Distance. It's great to have you with us today.
It's good to be with you. Thanks for the invitation.
So it's November 11th. We're in a tight spot here in the U.S. with our election and globally in a pandemic. What's at the top of your mind right now?
You know, this is one of those moments when you think people who are in my line of work are completely overloaded with information in terms of watching a lot of the activity on the ground. I think one of the things that we're trying not to do is get overwhelmed by the second-by-second TikTok. You know, it's not even minute-by-minute right now. Mm-hmm. The sort of pace of social media and other factors, you know, really sort of speed up the clock. And I think what we're looking at is kind of broader shifts in the world, broader shifts in kind of the society and culture, and trying to sort of understand, you know, the bigger picture of how the current events, quote unquote, might play out.
Mm. Do you have any instincts either way in terms of specifically what's going on with the challenging the election results?
You know, we've had this discussion kind of daily in the office and around the house. And I'm interested to kind of see what's going on outside the U.S., kind of looking for dogs that don't bark, to use that phrase, you know, looking for other entities' behaviors, other sort of groups' reactions and responses, who's reaching out to the transition team, for example, how are other people and other, you know, countries and groups behaving, acting, responding, because sometimes what you can't see from the inside can sort of be reflected in a mirror from the outside. You know, who else is getting worried?
Yeah.
Who's moving things around? Who's moving money around in the world? All those sorts of things that can kind of give you a sense of the bigger picture outside of the bubble that we can sit in, you know, within the kind of U.S. news sphere.
Mm. Your new book, How to Future, looks at how organizations can proactively shape their tomorrows and envision forward-looking possibilities. At a time like this, what are some of the ways in which we should be looking forward? We're stuck in a pandemic. What possible futures impacts should we be imagining?
I think one of the problems that we're kind of dealing with right now is people are sort of waiting for the future to play out. You know, we're all kind of sitting there in the stands in our comfortable chairs or uncomfortable chairs, waiting for someone else to make the move, waiting for another factor to happen to kind of show us which way the switch is going to go. You know, are we going to be moving right or left? Are we moving towards climate change or dealing with climate change? Are we moving towards social justice or not? Is the new technology going to change the picture? All of those things tend to be something that, you know, most people take a kind of passive position towards and don't actively get involved in the construction of what that future might be, or what futures are available, what pathways are out there for us. That's one big issue that this current environment has kind of really posed for us. You know, people, individuals, groups, societies, cultures, et cetera, have the ability, and organizations have the ability to kind of get in the game and proactively become involved in shaping what those pathways might be. And that's a big part of why we wrote the book, was to sort of make clear what some of those tools and approaches are, and even kind of habits of mind that can enable people to be more active in determining what futures are possible.
You write about the idea of sense making. Can you define what this is for us?
Sure. Sense making is, I think, from my point of view, just the act of kind of determining what's what, of looking for patterns in noise and looking for sort of the structures of information and how things fit together, so that you can begin to see a picture in what seems like a lot of either random information or disconnected things that are happening on a daily basis or factors that are sort of happening across the world from each other. Sensemaking is basically beginning to put pieces together to see a more coherent picture, a more coherent story about what's happening.
Mm. How, as a society, do you think we can cultivate habits of sort of everyday futuring or even taking a longer view? You know, when we have so many urgent needs and issues facing us this minute, this hour, this day.
One of the things that is really necessary is having a kind of vocabulary for that and having a structure for that. If it's just sort of left to us to imagine, you know, and work out on our own, it's quite difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, simple things of being able to sort of say, these are the things we know and these are the things we don't. These are the things that I have a lot of certainty about and these are the things I have less certainty about. You know, being able to sort of establish a kind of range or a ranking in a way in your mind of, you know, what's near, what's known, what's fixed and what's kind of changeable. What is and this is kind of using a word that we wouldn't normally use in our own brain, but what's a cultural phenomenon versus a political one? What's an economic change versus a technological one?
Mm.
Starting to have those small labels to put on things gives us the ability to begin sorting the phenomena that's happening around us.
Mm.
Everything that we sort of observe as we're walking through the world that we might otherwise ignore, you know, whether it's somebody else's behavior on the street next to us or a sign that wasn't there before, or a new piece of data in the newspaper that seems a little contradictory. All of these little things we let kind of pass by us and let perhaps someone else work out for us are things that we can actually begin to say, oh, actually, that's one of these. I'll put it here.
Mm.
And, you know, beginning to just kind of batch things together so you start to sort of see change happening over time in the same way you might if you're driving down the same street every day. You would notice little increments of change over time.
Many of the shortest term thinkers in our world tend to be autocrats. And I was wondering, why do you think we've seen a rise over the past decade in such leadership, whether it's President Trump, Putin, Duterte in the Philippines, Modi in India, Bolsonaro in Brazil?
That's a really interesting question. I think it's... I've been tempted in the past year or two to sort of try to write an article about how President Trump is actually a kind of secret futurist. And I don't mean that in the sense that you know, in a kind of overt, clever, strategic thinking way, but in a sort of visceral way, the way he sort of admires certain people and particularly certain landscapes, you know, is he trying to be friends with Kim in North Korea? Mm. Because he wants to, you know, reach strategic disarmament, or because he thinks coastal Korea might make some really amazing golf courses. And I think, I mean, that sounds funny, yeah. But I'm actually being serious. I think there's a kind of like deeper level processing of what is power and what are resources that you amass. And so I think in an autocrat's mind, you know, there's probably two things at work at the same time. One is the sort of what we see as the immediate protective behaviors of kind of amassing and maintaining power and resources and networks, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But I think behind that, there's always a little bit of a longer play, even if it seems very base level of what's the next thing I'm trying to get hold of?
Mm.
What's the next power play down the road? And so I think it just displays itself very much as short-term thinking. The long-term thinking doesn't seem to necessarily be that coherent, but I think there's always a kind of gut feeling of what the next thing might be.
Mm.
Self-preservation, essentially.
Yeah, you have to play a little bit of long ball for that, right? You've got to be able to sort of recognize where are there emergent threats?
Mm.
Who is sort of young and in the bureaucracy right now that might rise up to be a more, you know, older, wiser, more powerful opponent?
Yeah. It's interesting to think, you know, Trump right now is probably writing like 10 different exit strategies.
And yet none.
Yeah.
In a weird way, it's a sort of like embodied futuring in the sense of he's like kind of sensing and smelling what's going on around him and just almost subconsciously moving toward the thing, you know, the shark sort of swimming towards the food. And the people who sort of talk about, well, he's got these kind of master plan and this game and it's like, if this is a game, this is a pretty messed up game.
Yeah.
It's a game that's just throwing off, like, burning up resources and externalities all the time.
Mm.
not a very clever game.
Yeah, I wanted to bring up that, you know, the trend toward decoupled economies has been advancing. And after Trump has already progressed quite far, Biden ran on the concept of togetherness and healing. Do you think we will continue to see a trend away from the whole earth kind of sharing and thinking? Or what's your thought on that?
Well, I definitely think, you know, we'll probably see like the last days of globalization in the sense of, you know, what we've experienced in the past 30 or 40 years, you know, the kind of post-war years where we've all grown up and this sort of everything's becoming connected, everything is becoming globalized. You know, there's some things that Biden can change. I think you can sort of reintroduce late in the game some people who might be able to bring globalization to a softer landing than, say, you know, a sort of sudden lurch towards kind of rampant nationalism. But I think this decoupling is happening in part because it's difficult to maintain equity on a kind of global scale. You know, some people have to lose for other people to win. It's difficult to maintain complex global networks. It's difficult to keep something like the global internet running in a way that makes everybody happy. I think we sort of reach scale, kind of barriers of scale that mean we have to start looking closer, more locally. Mm. And, you know, whether that's on a national basis or even on a kind of community basis.
Mm. You write about the concept of four futures developed by Jim Dator to imagine a kind of future along one of four macros: growth, transformation, collapse, and discipline. And I was curious if we could spend a little bit of time unpacking the current moment, specifically with Biden, through the lens of four futures.
Sure. The origin of that four futures model came from looking at, you know, many, many different quote-unquote images that society has of the future. Which direction could we go? And when you boil all of those different images of the future down, Jim Dator, who's a professor in Hawaii, arrived at this kind of four archetypes.
Right.
And so they're a way of sort of almost putting macros on and saying, all right, let's take the next decade as one of growth. What does that look like? What happens? What's growing? Is it the economy that's growing? Society? Do we have abundance that's unlocked by some new technology? You know, what would that look like? And it's kind of the American dream circa 1998 kind of rebooted. And, you know, it's that abundance and kind of long boom idea that futurists had in the late 90s, that everybody gets wealthier, we have more things. I think that's a tough one to pull off because of the constraints that we now recognize. You know, there are literal limits to growth. Collapse could be we get to January 20th and all hell breaks loose. You know, there's a real kind of political contesting for power. We end up with a kind of pope and anti-pope, you know, two governments.
Civil war.
Yeah, sort of the thing that we point at other countries and go, don't do that. That, you know, you see a real breakdown in society and a kind of complete separation of the two big realities of kind of red America and blue America. Transformation, you know, maybe that looks like something like a Green New Deal, some kind of shift where we think about the economy differently. We think about the role of things like technology and innovation differently, not necessarily to grow in the sense of economic growth, but in the sense of completely re-engineering how we do things. You know, trying to stay under a 2-degree rise, you know, keeping with the Paris Accords, donut economics, all of these things that would sort of be an utter transformation in the way that we live, but towards something better, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Towards not, you know, our grandchildren not burning up in 100 years. And status quo is, you know, I think that's one thing that people have a fear about Biden as being just kind of Obama 2.0. We just kind of roll the tape back 4 years, 5 years, and continue on the same sort of fairly stable, steady, but not really productive long-term strategy.
Right, with a lot of obfuscation on what's actually happening.
There would have to be. You'd have to start kind of hiding more details, hiding more impacts, and trying to kind of make them disappear. And I don't think anybody really wants that at this point.
So I want to pull out the one, which is transformation, really quick. And what are your thoughts on AOC, the Green New Deal, the sort of that moment, because, you know, at least here in America, AOC is a very polarizing figure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard to not get behind her ideas. Sometimes it's hard to get behind the way she delivers them. Some people think it's necessary in this moment. Others think it's sort of repellent. What are your feelings about the Green New Deal and the new crop of leadership coming out like AOC?
I think, and this is probably easier to look at from outside the U.S. where I am. I mean, I'm sitting in the Netherlands where within Europe, looking back at America, and there are different kind of understandings or levels of favorability about green transformation, the Green New Deal in different parts of the world. A lot more investment happening here and sort of a stronger embrace. So I think one thing that needs to happen is that a kind of green transformation of the economy needs to be depersonalized, delinked from some of the voices that have done, you know, tremendous work in bringing it to the level that it's at now in the discussion. But as you know, we know about politics in the U.S., you can tie really critical issues like healthcare for everyone to what some people think is a polarizing individual, and that's a great way to sink the issue.
Mm-hmm.
To sort of throw out the baby with the bathwater. To
Yeah, take the guy you hate and name the healthcare plan after him.
I mean, yeah, it's like exactly.
A terrible idea.
I think there's a growing recognition across a really wide swath in America that something has to change, that you know, we can't continue sort of extractive economies, that climate change is real. We're what, on theta, I think, is the hurricane right now in the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
We're running out of alphabets. We'll have to move to another one. You know, little things like that should be indicators that we need to do something. And so I think there's a recognition that something will change. I think it's a brand of policy making and politics that's probably a little bit unusual in the U.S. because we don't really do transformation. There hasn't really been a kind of, you know, bottom-up transformation of the economy really since World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And it means changing lifestyle. It means changing resource availability. People may have to do certain things with less. You have 350 million people that are going to have to go through a resource bottleneck. That bottleneck may be very, very small or maybe very wide, but you're asking a lot of people to change their behavior.
Yeah. Do you think that it's possible a New Deal level reform coming out of a Biden presidency?
You know, I have hope, if for no other reason than legacy, that they'll actually do something meaningful and appoint people who will make meaningful change, appoint economists, people at the Fed, Treasury, who recognize that climate change is an economic factor.
Yeah.
People in healthcare, people in education and defense across the board. I think today, just an hour ago, I saw an announcement kind of flash by about, you know, bringing HHS and Treasury and other entities into the conversation. It's not something you just sit at the EPA.
Yeah.
The CDC yesterday made a case for face masks. If we wear face masks, could inject $1 trillion back into the economy. I mean, now these issues are finally interdisciplinary.
Absolutely. And I think they have been all along, but the problem was communicating the connection. Mm. You know, we've managed sort of one neat trick in the pandemic, which was, you know, connecting face masks to incidents of COVID. Adherence, no. But, you know, getting people to at least sort of recognize there's a curve here.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big move.
Yeah.
on a kind of national level for the U.S.
Mm.
You know, so maybe these other factors, like we can put X trillions of dollars towards your grandchildren or your children or their education or other things we can afford to do if we make this change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I want to bring up this tweet that you sent out a few months ago. You wrote, "Strive for systems views, be suspect of systems theories." And in the context of what we're talking about, I was wondering if you could elaborate on that.
I think what I was getting at there was, it's really, really important to understand how things are connected. Just what we were talking about, mm-hmm. right there. The idea that if you move this, that changes. If you change your behavior here, something else is affected. That systems, that we live in systems, and systems are complex, but systems are connected. And so the change we make in one part of society or on one coast can really affect the other.
Mm.
That small change can be meaningful over time. It's really critical for people to sort of see how things are connected around them. That said, it's really easy to fall prey to simplifying all of that down to a kind of theory, you know, a pop theory that can kind of take hold. And so I'm always kind of keen to open people's eyes to the linkages between the things that happen in their daily lives and the world around them, but also try to steer people away from just accepting, for example, what one author says in one book, mm-hmm. that's this genius theory that we can all operate on. And then 3 years later, we find that that's discredited.
Mm. Yeah, on the climate crisis front, you know, systems-based thinking is essential, you know, especially when scarcity of resources is going to increasingly demand it. So I was wondering, you know, how do you think the climate crisis is going to impact how corporations and governments are run? And do you think environmental disaster is ultimately going to steer and control the conversation, or will it always kind of be humans fallible and the other way around?
I think we tend to only really learn when we burn ourselves. That kind of, you know, hand on a hot stove is actually going to be things like, you know, billions of dollars of real estate on the Florida coast, mm-hmm. or, you know, massive investments that have to be redirected into things like infrastructure and public health that could have gone to things like education. You know, when we really see the physical costs of things, mm-hmm. you know, people's insurance going up in Ohio because they're having to pay for flooding in houses in Mississippi. We start to sort of see those linkages that we refuse to really recognize before. I think just purely on a kind of self-interest basis that you'll see, I mean, business is already moving. You're starting to see much more recognition of the potential costs and impacts. And, you know, when you have to do things like strand billions of dollars of assets in oil and gas generation because you can no longer use them, or you are, you know, divesting from assets that are no longer valuable to you, all of those sorts of things that you have to start making financial set-asides to hedge risk. That stuff is already in the mix now. You know, major insurers, if you read their annual reports, the big global insurers are well into this.
Yeah.
The big energy companies are already sort of saying, this part of the business we can no longer count on. We're going to have to write it off. Mm. So I think just purely in kind of economic self-interest, businesses is making the jump. It will increasingly become good business to do as that gets closer to the consumer. I mean, you look at things like, you know, electric vehicle sales. You know, the shift in transportation is moving faster now than the automakers expected. Most of them kind of dragged their feet for a while. You had a few early movers, but now you see this sudden scramble to catch up. How do we get rid of these internal combustion engines in the factories and the perhaps even the workers that have been building them? Mm. And shift over. Government, you know, often follows behind last. But I do think that there's more direct pressure now and more recognition that this is a thing. This is a big issue. And this is something that's, you know, if a Biden administration, for example, does put it and keep it squarely centered, that will be a sea change in the way that governments, it'll be a signal.
Well, I guess we're going to have to see what their relationship with Silicon Valley is, which is the root of so much of this. I mean, we often don't think about Silicon Valley as an environmental threat, although in many ways it really is. I did want to talk a bit about the Valley and technology, which I know you're very up on. And when we think about the fundamental technology changes that are occurring, AI is kind of at the center of this. This is the trigger for so much change. What are your thoughts in general now about AI, and what do you sense is around the corner?
I think AI is at an interesting point right now. There's been a huge amount of hype and, of course, a kind of both investment boom and you know, businesses everywhere trying to find ways to apply it either for real or kind of AI washing their technology. And it feels like it's kind of entering a reset phase, a sort of reconsideration of what have we learned? What have we learned in terms of where it can be useful and where it may not be useful yet? What are the sort of interesting development models for AI? You know, what kinds of neural networks or machine learning algorithms, et cetera, are kind of valuable, but also where we've sort of seen overshoot, you know, overpromise. There's been a lot of hype this year, for example, around things like GPT-3, which is the sort of natural or neural net driven language AI that sort of, you know, people think can write, you know, a newspaper article or a book or, you know, a Netflix blockbuster. And the real capability of those technologies is actually a bit further behind what's being kind of advertised. We still are in the loop. We humans, the sort of, you know, directors of the technology, have to intervene quite a lot to kind of clean up, stitch together, and make things work. But at the same time, we now have kind of neural net driven filters in Photoshop as of last month. Mm-hmm. So it's having a kind of weird distribution, but I think AI, we have to kind of step back for a little bit and take stock of what's working and what isn't, and how does the technology catch up with that.
And how far away actually anything truly fearful is.
Yeah, and I think, I guess it's the question of where's the fear and what's it about? Is it that we're creating something that's going to run away from us, that we can't really trust the people who are around us right now to implement it properly, whether it's going to displace my job or, you know, engage in racial profiling because of the training data that it's received, mm-hmm. you know, all of these sorts of factors. And, you know, I think it's good to be concerned in as much as it raises very public questions about the ethical boundaries of development, mm-hmm. and raises non-specialist people's awareness of what they should be looking for and what they should be, how much they should understand. Can a citizen on the street in Chicago, do they have the language to say, I don't want that kind of machine learning racial profiling going on in your pre-crime unit? You know, we're just about to that point where the average person on the street can actually speak to some of those complexities.
Mm. I mean, it's so much about the self, which is the other part of the conversation I wanted to bring up right now. The kind of digital identity or digital self has been developing over the last decade or so, I imagine, has certainly been accelerated through the pandemic, with just the amount of time we're presenting ourselves digitally or defining ourselves through what we're consuming. Where do you see this going? Will we be retracting, as many think, sort of Gen Z kind of pushing it away? Or we, you know, and only trusting a kind of physical self or the real experience? Or will we become an amalgamation of both?
We sort of talk about it as a sort of identity stack, which I guess is almost putting it too much in technology terms. But it's almost inescapable that we're all sort of a walking bundle of many different forms of digital identity, whether it's, you know, very kind of defined, structured things like biometric information, you know, your fingerprints, your voice print, your signature, all those sorts of things, or if it's a persona that you're projecting on this photo sharing platform that's also not your Twitch host persona over here. And if you think about the number of platforms and tools that we log into and sort of are present in every day, we're really kind of fractal entities now. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, it's a very, very multifaceted thing. It's almost impossible to sort of say what is the self outside of kind of classic psychological model.
Yeah.
So I don't know that it's actually kind of retracting or that Gen Z or the generations beyond it will be moving away from it as much as probably becoming a lot more comfortable and fluent in orchestrating or understanding the connections between all of those identities.
Mm. I guess connected to this, but sort of stacked on top of everything we've been discussing, what do you think leadership in the future is going to look like? How will it be different from today?
I think the leadership model of the future, and really who we're looking towards today, is very much situational, where you still have this model of choosing and grooming and educating and building leaders, you know, still very much out of a kind of, it's kind of an elitist view, right? We know who the leaders in society are going to be, so let's pour all of our resources into them. And if you think about some of the most incredible people that have emerged in the landscape in the past few decades, they've been people who have kind of stepped out of nowhere, who have said, I see what's going on here. I can do something about it. Mm-hmm. I can bring some order to this chaos, and sort of stepped into the gap. And I think partly because the world's going to continue to be more kind of complex and chaotic and turbulent, and partly because we are opening up to the participation of many, many more people and kinds of people from different backgrounds, and partly because of that kind of failure of the rigid leadership model, we'll see much more of a kind of situational leadership model emerge, where people are able to step forward in a company or an organization and say, I know something about that, let me guide this process. You know, I have insight here, let me interject it. That's easier to do now that we have kind of flatter our organizations and not the old kind of hierarchical model of that business has been kind of built on for the past century.
Yeah. And more women and people of color in leadership roles.
Absolutely. I mean, again, look at politics in this cycle just now. You see some names that were, you know, people didn't talk about before or no one saw coming. You know, they're all of the sort of rising stars are less people that have been groomed in the best schools and, you know, gone to Georgetown and GW and Harvard Kennedy Government School. And they're people who are coming from real live experience, mm-hmm. who can bring that experience to making change in the world. And I was saying to my partner the other day that, you know, the number of new voices that you saw kind of emerge over the summer in Black Lives Matter or the surrounding kind of activities, people who were stepping up, speaking in very moving, direct, honest, and kind of crystal tones, you know, really galvanizing people who were listening to them. Mm. Those aren't people who had speech class or, you know, learned the art of rhetoric or studied the great speeches. They're people who are speaking from their own experience directly in the moment. And they're people whose names you remember. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been a real a welcome shift in politics. The ability for people to kind of rise to the top, just as we, you know, we may suffer from the ability of influencers to kind of, you know, go from nothing to a million views and live in a collab house in LA. The flip side of that is, you know, the ability of people to emerge and make real social change.
Yeah. Are there any examples you could share of companies or leaders who you think are really pushing this conversation forward, who are changing the world as we know it and for the better?
Wow, I always hate questions like
that. Specific ones, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Specific questions are tough. There's so much of a kind of chase for attention and being the sort of woke corporation for the moment, mm-hmm. that, you know, it's hard to see organizations kind of cutting through that. We've had experience, for example, with a number of NGOs that we work with, so, you know, International Red Cross or UNDP, mm-hmm. and groups like that are really elevating, again, a very diverse, smart, young group of leaders around the world who they're not, again, mm-hmm. tapping, you know, with a magic wand and saying, you are a leader, but they're kind of learning how to get out of the way.
Yeah.
I think that's a really important factor here, is how do organizations step back and let people take on the roles that they can fulfill?
Mm. Yeah, you're wearing a Patagonia jacket, and that's a brand to me that I just think, you know, really has managed to push through this moment and not only stay relevant, but contribute to so much conversation.
They're a really good example in the sense of setting up a kind of clear model for circular economies, you know, making it look and seem, you know, financially viable. That's kind of critical, as, you know, companies won't do things that are going to be sort of financially deleterious. You know, you have to have kind of bolder companies step out front. But Patagonia has kind of pushed that vision for years now. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's the thing. It's like I see them as sort of being, you know, almost part of the old guard in a way of a newer generation of companies. Mm. But maybe I have the high bar for being impressed. I feel like it's going to take a lot more aggressive action.
Yeah.
And companies making moves that are sort of self-sacrificing in the sense that they're just cutting off something that they could still make a lot of money off of or still have a market in.
Yeah. I mean, not a lot of companies would have the guts to put vote the assholes out tags on their jackets, and Patagonia managed to do that. And
yeah,
probably at a big profit too.
Possibly. But I mean, they're, you know, we need to go further. I mean, every time you get a Whole Foods, do people feel the same about Whole Foods that they did 15 or 20 years ago? No.
Yeah.
It's become part of another empire. I guess I'm always kind of cautious about, you know, who is really kind of doing something meaningful, particularly in kind of consumer markets. Mm. Whereas, you know, the ability of other organizations that are unseen and kind of unheralded to step forward and do the really heavy lifting in the world. And I think, I mean, I live here in The Hague, which is a center of kind of NGO and third sector, you know, relief organizations and organizations that are doing really amazing work around the world that don't get as much attention.
Yeah.
And one of the wonderful things is they're really starting to kind of take on futures tools and techniques to be able to get beyond just reactive response to the next crisis the minute it happens.
Before we let you go, one final question was, as we're sort of emerging from this moment, the chaos around the election, the global pandemic, this just really tough critical moment we're in as a species. What is giving you hope?
I think the thing that's giving me hope is the the sort of unstoppable energy of a lot of my younger colleagues and peers who, you know, while they may not have kind of the full direction ahead of them that they'd like to have, their energy to push for change and their kind of impatience with making that change happen is something I think that only comes around every few generations. And it's remarkable the ability that they have to, and I count my own kind of teenage kids in this, you know, their ability to normalize change rapidly and sort of internalize it and make it happen is, I think we're going to need that kind of human energy. We're going to need that sort of persistence. And the people turning out on the streets in the US and around the world this summer, you know, whether it was in Hong Kong or on the streets in America, I'm always amazed at how people will put themselves in the way to make something meaningful change.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Scott. This was really, really fantastic.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation. This was a great conversation.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter, Exploring the Five Senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.